Welcome, everybody, to the Friday edition of the RotoWire Fantasy Baseball Podcast. It's Paul Spohr here, flying solo. Got a lot going on right now for both Doug and myself. Doug and his wife are expecting a baby soon, and so he's up to his eyeballs in non-baseball-related stuff. And I'm actually moving this weekend, so I had a tight window that I could fit the podcast into. And since it didn't marry up very well with Doug's availability, I told him I'd just go ahead and fly solo. Let him go ahead and get to work on all that, all the stuff of preparing for a baby that comes along with it. So cover some of the news and then kind of freeform it a bit. I'm not really sure. Obviously, this is going to come out a little bit later on Friday afternoon, so talking DraftKings for tonight is not going to be very useful. You could basically, not use the picks. You could just make fun of them when they inevitably fall flat. So we'll avoid that. Like I said, just going to kind of freeform it, but let's start with the news. We got Christian Yelich heading to the disabled list with the back injury, this lower back strain. Had been keeping him out for a while, and now it's going to go ahead and put him to the disabled list. Ichiro Suzuki is in the lineup Friday for him. It's looking like he's going to be the guy who kind of takes over there. You know, Ichiro obviously has name value as high as, you know, just about anybody when you think of actual just, oh, wow, that guy's a superstar name-wise. But at 41, he doesn't have anywhere near the fantasy value to match that name value. And that remains the case. You know, he can fake it out there right now as a fringe major leaguer. And I hate even saying that because he's such an excellent player, an elite-level player, from his late 20s all throughout his 30s that we got to watch here in the States. But you know, he wasn't very good last year or 2013, you know, both with the Yankees. Those were rough seasons. A little bit of fantasy value with the batting average, some okay speed, but not special AL-only kind of stuff. He's NL-only kind of stuff now. But if you need a guy with some at-bats coming, Ichiro is somebody that you can look at. Maybe he gets lucky and swipes a handful of bags. So still worth taking a look at. NL-only, super deep mixed league. But overall, not a huge move here. I'm a little bit intrigued by Justin Bour being called up. That's B-O-U-R. He's a first base type, maybe even a bit more of a DH, but obviously that's not going to matter in Miami. So as long as he's in the National League, he's going to have to play first base. But I believe he's a Rule 5 pick from a couple years ago. So I don't, obviously the Rule 5 status doesn't matter anymore. I mentioned it just to kind of give you an idea of his path. And he was excellent last year, off to an okay start so far in AAA this year. Did some decent things with the Marlins even last year. When I said excellent last year, I meant in the minors. Bohr did some decent things with the Marlins in 2014 last year, only 83 plate appearances. I think this guy could be a sneaky one too. Same kind of formats as Ichiro though, you know, NL only, maybe super deep mix where anybody with a pulse matters. Can't really see him on the mixed level scene right now, or on the mixed league scene right now, because Justin Bohr just, I don't know where the playing time is going to come from. But if an injury opened up something for him more long term, I'd be really excited about this guy. So keep Justin Bohr at least on your radar. Go get Ichiro in NL only, super deep mixed if you need it. Elsewhere, it looks like Bobby Parnell is going to be shut down for at least a week due to forearm soreness. He's coming back from Tommy John, so forearm soreness, obviously not great. Now that we have the estimated return here at RotoWire as 525, that's going to open up a great big window for Juris Familia. Coming into the season, I was pretty high on Henry Mejia, and my thing, here's the point I'm trying to make, because Mejia obviously didn't work out. He got hurt. Now he's out. Familia's been the guy. But my thing was I never worried about Parnell. He was not. He was a non-factor for me. I thought whoever had this job, I thought it was going to be Mejia, thought could handle and keep it all year, even when Parnell came back. Now Familia has come in and just been electric. You know, 9 2/3 innings, 8 saves. That spans 10 appearances, a 1.86 ERA is, of course, great. 12 strikeouts, 3 walks, only allow 1 homer. Everything is clicking for Juris Familia right now. So with about a month that Parnell's not even going to come back, this really gives Familia a chance. I mean, I think he already has, but even if you're wavering a little bit, with this extra time here, that's going to shut Parnell down for a week before he's even going to pitch again, and whatever time it would take to get back into then, Familia is going to have that locked down, I think, to a point where it's not going to be really a question of whose job it is, even as the Mets get whole again, not only with Parnell, but also with Mejia. Troy Tulowitzki's out of the lineup on Friday, which I'm sure bums out DFS folks. The Rockies are still in Coors, so everyone's going to be playing Giants and Rockies. Looks like a standard day off, though. And so that's the read that we've got up on the site right now, so that's good. Daniel Descalso will get the start. Nothing to really freak out about either way. So just want to make people aware that if you see him out on a Friday, that's kind of a bummer, though. That's kind of a tough day for a standard off day. Friday, you figure a lot of people can get out to the game on a Friday evening. They want to see the big ticket, and, that would be Troy Tulowitzki. So hopefully he's in for both weekend games at least. Joe Wieland for the Dodgers is going to start either Saturday or Sunday, according to the Los Angeles Times' Dylan Hernandez. I like this. Mike Bolsinger was in the rotation. I didn't understand that necessarily. Maybe Wieland wasn't available at that point when they needed a fifth starter, because the Dodgers haven't had a set fifth starter right now with Hyunjin Ryu out. They've been going with Kershaw, Greinke, Brett Anderson, and Brandon McCarthy, of course. McCarthy's been fantastic. So, yeah, they're kind of hurting at the back end there, and Brett Anderson hasn't been very good. So not only are they looking for a fifth, but they might be even looking for a fourth sooner than later. Joe Wieland, I like. In that particular role as a fourth, fifth starter type, this was a guy who had a bit of prospect status with Texas, which is who originally drafted him, and then was traded to San Diego, which was a perfect fit for him. He and Robbie Erlin were traded together. They're both a couple of fly ball command and control guys, so getting out of Texas and into San Diego couldn't have worked out better. Obviously, Wieland has since been traded from the Padres to the Dodgers, but that's not a terrible thing. Obviously, you prefer Petco to Chavez Ravine, but Chavez Ravine isn't a bad place to pitch. And, Wieland, even for his fly ball tendencies, has never really had a major home run issue. So even though Chavez Ravine is a bit friendly to home runs, I don't think it's something that's going to kill him. I like him. Again, unfortunately, I don't know if there's going to be much mixed league appeal on this one. But you got to keep an eye on him, because obviously with pitchers, it can change so quickly. They get a couple good starts, and then everyone's picking them up. Keep an eye on him. I think it can be useful. 15-teamer, if you're desperate for a pitcher, go ahead. But otherwise, keep this limited to NL onlys. But in NL onlys, I would jump right now, take a shot on him. I don't think he's going to light everything up, with huge strikeouts or anything like that. But somebody who can do, have an adequate number of strikeouts, say something in the 7.5 to 8 range on a per-9 basis with good ratios. That's what we're looking for here. And then, of course, as part of that ball club, with the Dodgers, Joe Wieland has a great chance at picking up wins. And we can't predict wins, obviously, but you can create, or you can set yourself up in situations that are going to give you an opportunity for more wins. And obviously, being a part of the Dodgers will do that for Joe Wieland. Next up is Devin Mesoraco, who's going to be out again on Friday with a hip. And this is becoming a bit of a problem now at this point. I had a tough time with him coming into the year because of his health profile or lack thereof, as it were. So Devin Mesoraco, for me, as great as his season was, I was just worried. I had him at a keeper spot in a couple leagues where I had to keep him because it was just too good of a price, and you're not putting 25 homers and 80 ribbies back on the market for the cost of a 20th round pick, something like that. But as far as getting him in redraft leagues where the price had really gone up, I was a lot more hesitant. Yes, he did that 25 and 80. That was fantastic. But he really smushed that in to 114 games, which even when you give the discount for catchers who don't catch every single game, that was still low. You're still looking for about 130 to 140 games at least from your catcher. And Mesoraco, like I said, delivered 114. It was a career high. But the health profile just really worries me about him. It's kind of why Mesoraco was a late bloomer. He could never really stay healthy. A hip for a catcher, that seems awful. This is worrisome to me. I think I would entertain selling out of my shares. I haven't yet in the two leagues where I do have them. It's just something I haven't looked at. But if somebody maybe came my way as looking to buy low, I think I might find a way to wiggle out of there. catchers are just this is why they're so tough for fantasy. You know, they just get hurt a lot of times. They're putting themselves in danger behind the plate for sure. The crouching when it comes to knees and you know, things like that, it worries me. Add in the fact that Mesoraco already had a rough health profile, and yeah, I'm ready to sell out. I'm not ready to sell out on Jose Bautista, even though he's an idiot, and he's not an idiot for the reason that you might think. I don't care that he pimped his home run off of Jason Garcia after Garcia threw behind him, because whether it was intentional or not, you still got a ball coming, you know, 90-something miles an hour behind you. That's going to piss you off. I get that. So you take him yards, something Bautista has done regularly. Guy throws behind him and misses. Next pitch, a couple pitches later, Bautista goes yards. So he does that. Okay, great. But still, he was so angry and so heated that later, the next inning, I believe, Delmon Young hits a floater, you know, a decent enough single, or actually pretty well struck, I should say, because obviously in order to even have a chance at this, it has to be pretty well struck. So Young rips one out there to right field, and Bautista wants to get tough guy and throw him out. And it's like he's only doing it because he's pissed. I believe the game was out of reach at that point. So he really put himself in harm's way there. And now his shoulder has been ailing since then. And it is said to be related to that maneuver there, to him really trying to gun out Delmon Young at first base there. So he's missed a couple games already, has Bautista. He's expected to be back over the weekend, but let's keep an eye on that. And the reason I said I'm not selling out on him, he's hitting .149 right now. I'm not really that worried. I'm really not. First off, the fact that he has he's hitting .149 and still has a 748 OPS tells you how excellent he's been at every other facet right now. It's basically just singles aren't dropping for him. He's still got four bombs. He's got 11 walks against 12 strikeouts. He just hasn't had any hits fall right now. And I think Jose Bautista will be fine. If you could come anywhere close to buying low, which is actually kind of an easy thing to do, because in a one-for-one, if you're paying anything less than a first-round pick, I think you're buying low. I still think Jose Bautista is a first-round pick. So even if you gave your second-round pick, do it. Absolutely do it. I would send out any offer I could right now for Bautista and maybe start with my third-round pick and move up. Now, I know it's hard because not a lot of trades are exactly one-for-one. You know, it's usually kind of a mix. But obviously, you'll have to determine what you're dealing with there. But he's still a first-rounder to me. He was a bona fide first-round draft pick. He's still a first-rounder. If anyone is even the slightest bit panicked on the 149 average or the sore shoulder for Jose Bautista, I'm ready to pounce on that. A couple of returns coming up now. Bautista's teammate, Michael Saunders, is expected to be activated over the weekend. Now, I have another podcast that I do with Eno Saris over at Fangraphs. It's called The Sleeper and the Bus. We were talking about this, and we were just kind of wondering out loud if Saunders might be a little bit pinched for playing time upon return because of how well his replacement has done defensively. Now, you know, because the impetus was a piece written at the site about how much defense can maybe help us with fantasy. And right now we think, you know, it's not that much. It's hard to translate defensive stuff into fantasy usefulness. Well, the crux of the article was surmising that maybe looking at the guys at the high end and the low end could be a playing time situation. And then taking that a step further, Eno and I were talking about Saunders returning and then seeing that two of the best defensive guys early on have been Kevin Pillar and Dalton Pompey in left and center for the Blue Jays, two positions that Saunders can play. Now, if Bautista is nicked and isn't returning, that's an obvious fit. Saunders is going to be out there with Pillar and Pompey. But when Bautista's healthy, and I think Pompey isn't going anywhere because they love him, it then kind of comes down to Pillar against Saunders. Saunders is the much better hitter, but if Pillar's playing exemplary defense, I think Saunders could have his playing time pinched. So be careful of that. If you're acquiring him off the wire in a 10 or 12 team mixed league, which is probably possible. He seems pretty widely available right now because he hasn't played yet this year. So if you're doing that, be careful in thinking that you're going to get a guy who is, you know, even an automatic strong side platoon guy in Saunders. He can do some good things. I was pretty excited about him moving out to Toronto this year. That's a great park to hit in. Saunders has a near 2020 season in his past. 2012, he was 19 homers, 21 stolen bases. Even last year, 12-13 in 132 games isn't bad. It's just that's the fantasy environment we're in right now. You can get double digits in homers and steals from somebody. You're interested. Actually, that was a 2013 season. That wasn't last year. Last year, injuries got him again. He only played 78 games, and Saunders had 8 homers, 4 stolen bases. 4 stolen bases on 9 attempts. So we also have to be careful about if the speed component is still a part of his game. But right now, at least in the short term, I worry a little bit about how much playing time he's going to get when I thought for sure he would be strong side platoon guy at the very least coming into this year as a left-hander. Now, Pilar is a right-hander, so I think it'll play itself into a natural platoon. But early on, if Toronto's looking at that defensive piece, they might be willing to say, you know what, we're going to give Pilar these opportunities a handful more than we normally would have because this defense has been so exemplary. And then two from another team, disabled list returns include James Loney and Drew Smyly. And obviously, the Rays need all the pieces that they can get. They're kind of piecing it together this year. They're 8-8, though. So for as bad as people kind of perceive them right now, they're actually doing some pretty good things. I am a little bit nervous about them, I guess, because I don't know. You know, they obviously made some moves this year. They lost Joe Maddon, and then they come into the season with Smyly and Cobb on the shelf. That worried me. But I guess to have treaded water and be 8-8 as they get the first of the two stud arms back, that's pretty good because the hitting has really been solid from a lot of different areas that kind of weren't the star pieces. Evan Longoria has done okay. He's been a little bit above average, not great. Desmond Jennings has been wretched. Asdrubal Cabrera has been wretched. So those were supposed to be kind of the three guys that really got it going. And Kiermaier and Souza and DeJesus, they're kind of leading the charge. Kiermaier and Souza, especially. DeJesus hasn't been playing quite as much. And, they desperately needed Loney back, though, because even though he only got to play one game before he was out, Alan Dykstra not getting it done. And it's early, but he's just not getting it done. They need Loney out there for his defense and for his hitting. This team could be sneaky. They really could. I'm inclined to not really believe in them, but the second you start not believing in the Rays is when they really come out of nowhere with a handful of guys that do really well. I like Drew Smyly. That's going to be a big return. Unfortunately, he has to go against the aforementioned Blue Jays right out of the gate. That's not a fun matchup for a lefty to face them, to face the Blue Jays in your first outing of the season. So we'll see how Smyly comes back from that. Honestly, if he comes out and really shuts them down, that's going to be a huge jolt, I think, for the Rays, because then they're going to be having their first horse back, and then they'll get their ace back soon, hopefully Alex Cobb. So that's about it for the news in terms of injuries and what's going on. Oh, I should mention Dexter Fowler's back in the lineup on Friday. He missed about a game and a half with, I think, some groin tightness, and Chris Bryant played center field both times. He was the fill-in, but then he was the surprise starter for the game that Fowler missed, and I think that had some people, you know, freaking out a little bit. Now, I didn't see a big deal with it. I thought it was pretty cool. That's how athletic and awesome Chris Bryant is, so why not let him? Anyway, let's see what's up next. I mentioned I would kind of freeform the second half of the show here, and I am going to go ahead and do that, just kind of talk about some random players, really, maybe looking over the leaderboard, seeing some guys who are jumping out early, and maybe kind of giving my thoughts on whether or not I believe that they can continue to do it. I guess we'll kind of go around the diamond here and just look at some guys who were drafted much later, who are having a good start, and maybe just decide, hey, is it believable or not? Let's start behind the dish with Stephen Vogt, and this was a guy who I've lamented on Twitter, maybe even on this very show, I can't remember, to having missed out on him. And I just think I got this one wrong. And it wasn't that I was anti-Vogt by any stretch of the imagination. It's just that I didn't really pay him any mind whatsoever. There were other catchers I liked. He didn't come into the season with catcher eligibility, so you were going to have to do some finagling, maybe put him at your utility or your corner, and then draft a bunk catcher, you know, some $1 scrub or your very last pick that you were immediately going to boot 5 games into the season because Vogt would get his eligibility that way. So maybe it was the extra work that it took, even though that's really not a big deal. I kind of missed out on him. I think one thing that I thought was, I thought Stephen Vogt played more last year, and so his 9 home runs were a bit unimpressive to me. But Vogt hit the 9 homers in 84 games, and so, you know, easily, you know, if you kind of do the rough math in your head, it's close to an 18 homer season, obviously. But let's back off on that, obviously, because he's not going to play 162 games. Plus, it would take, 168 for that anyway. But even if you back a handful off there, you're still looking at like a 14 or something homer kind of guy who had 279 as well. So if you can get that kind of batting average from catcher too, that's really impressive. And Vogt has obviously come out of the gate showing that maybe an 18 or better homer pace is what he should be on, because he's already got 4 right out of the gate. Maybe he is a 20 homer kind of guy. And if he can do it while continuing to hit for batting average, then he's going to be one of the best catchers in the game. I expect that Stephen Vogt will slow down from his 360 average, his 1141 OPS, and 4 homers every 15 games. Let's be clear here. That's not necessarily he wouldn't have to be at this good of a start for me to lament missing out on him. I just have watched him and been very impressed with the skills and the contact ability. I just wish I'd have been a bit more impressed in the winter so that I could have come into the season looking to get him. But I do believe a good bit in what we've seen, in that he's going to have streaks like this, that his skills, that when they're hot, they're going to play out this way. And yes, he's going to have the inevitable cold slumps that every single guy is going to hit this year. Every guy will have a cold slump, usually a couple. It just ebbs and flows. It's a 6-month season. So yes, he's not going to continue at this level, but that doesn't mean that he's not for real and very good. So I think Stephen Vogt is somebody that early on you can kind of believe in what you've seen. I wouldn't necessarily be out trying to sell high unless you were able to do something particularly ridiculous and do like Vogt for Posey. And even at that point, you're probably going to have to run into veto stuff, and you don't want to deal with that anyway, because that's just crazy. So I don't think that, you know, Vogt for Yadi Molina. Nah, I stick with Vogt. I'll keep that surplus value there and do something else. I don't think you necessarily need to do that. Vogt for Jonathan Lucroy. Well, Lucroy's hurt right now. I love Lucroy, but I don't think I can do that either. I'm trying to think of who else. You know, Sal Perez. Sal Perez off to a great start as well. You know what? We know Ned Yost is going to ride him into the ground anyway, whereas Oakland seems to really manage their players, and you know Vogt will get the necessary time off. But one good thing about Vogt is that when he does get time off from behind the dish, he won't necessarily go right to the bench, because he played a whole bunch of other spots last year. He played first base. He's played left field, right field. He's DH'd, and the A's really interchange their parts, so they're not going to want that bat out of the lineup too often. So I think Stephen Vogt might actually get an advantage there, that while getting the same kind of volume that Perez is, that Sal Perez is, his won't be behind the dish, so it won't wear on him nearly as much, whereas I do worry about Sal Perez being run down again by Ned Yost. Let's move over to first base, and I'm kind of doing a rough. These guys went pick 150 or later. I might be a little off on some of them, but for the most part, these guys went, you know, after pick 150, which is obviously the 10th round of a 15-teamer, and, you know, the 13th or so round of a 12-teamer. And wait, did I say? Yeah, I said 10th round of a 15-teamer, and then the 15th round, obviously, of a 10-teamer. We can all figure out that simple math there. So, you know, these are guys that were going later. Those are the kind of rounds that can really make or break your draft. Though we all kind of know the guys that are going to go in those first 3 rounds, and we'll have differences in how we value them. And obviously, they are very important, but where you really win your draft, where you separate yourself from a league, is getting those first through fourth round type of players and talents in the 13th, 15th, 18th, whatever it is, you know, something double digit round. That's how you win. When you find a Michael Brantley who goes off, when you get an Anthony Rendon who goes off for you and delivers that big value. So that's why we're focused on that kind of area of the draft and looking at these early performers. And over at first base, I'm liking Lucas Duda and a lot of what he's doing early on. We haven't seen the raw power that we saw last year just yet, but that's because he's been changing his approach a little bit to add a little bit more contact in there. But it's not necessarily weak contact. It's just some pop the other way, and it's been resulting more in doubles than home runs so far. But if you know, I don't need – I love the 30 homers from last year. 30 homers, 253 average, you know, did nothing against lefties. That was all against righties. I'll give back five of those homers for 25 points in batting average, though. He's up at 351 right now, which is 98 points higher than he was last year. I don't think that's necessarily going to hold, but he could be a 275, 280 hitter. And, like I said, I would trade the five home runs for that. I think that would be better value, but I'm not even sure that we'll have to trade the home runs. I'm just saying that it would be a perfectly fine trade, but the way he's hitting right now, is dialed in as he is, I think the power is still going to come. I don't think this is a blatant trade-off of pop for average. I think, yes, things are going well. He's going the other way. He's getting hits. He's 7 for 14 against lefties right now, which is, you know, unheard of, even for a small sample, given what he had done against lefties. I'm not sure. I'm going to look this up. I'm not sure he had 7 hits against lefties last year. Okay, he had 20. But he had 20 in 111 at-bats, and Duda's 7 for 14 so far. So, and they've done breakdowns on this on MLB Network. They've been following it, and they're showing that he is, you know, legitimately going the other way with solid hits. This is not, you know, 4 infield hits, 2 bunts, something like that. It is actual process change, but still driving the ball. What I'm loving from Lucas Duda right now is the K rate is way down, 17%. That's massive. That's down from 23% last year for Duda. So he's out there, you know, not missing and putting the ball in play. Obviously, sky high BABIP to get that great batting average is at 422. It's going to come down. Like we said, I know that. I'm not worried about that. But he was a OBP gem, and that's still continuing. He's still walking at a 12% clip. Everything's clicking right now except for the fact that you wish maybe he had a couple more homers. I wouldn't sweat it. I think the power's coming. He's got a weird 6% homer to fly ball rate. His career's 13%, and Duda was at 16% last year. I think that will regress out nicely for him, and even if he only gets up to kind of a league average 11, 12%, I think he'll be fine, but he's a power guy. His power plays everywhere. I think he'll be within the 13 to 16% range that we've seen each of the last 3 years out of Lucas Duda. I'm buying in early on this surge for him, and he's helping the Mets not really miss David Wright quite as much as they go through this big run. So Lucas Duda is someone I think you can confidently buy into, assuming you didn't already last year, because like I said, he had an electric year last year with 30 homers, and I can't believe how late he was going, given that he hit 30 homers. You know, even when you understand the flaws against lefties, I thought that would have more value in the market, and it just didn't, and it made Duda a great value this year. Next up is second base, of course, and I don't think I could get away without talking about Devon Travis here. I just don't know that anybody would want to hear about any other second baseman that's off to a quality start over him. Yeah, DJ LeMay, he was hitting like 9 trillion, but I think his batting average on balls in play is you know, 750 or something absurd. Actually, let me pull that up. DJ LeMahieu is actually hitting 389, so he's way down from where he was. He's batting 500 through like the first 10 games of the season. He's got a 444 batting average on balls in play. I mean, it's a boatload of singles, and that's fine. I mean, you know, I've been using him in DFS and enjoying those hits. Singles play, I'll take it. But he's got 21 hits and just 3 for extra bases. He's got one of each, a double, triple, and a homer. So I'm not getting crazy about him. I think he's a pretty easy, you know, don't buy in. I don't want to say sell, because what are you going to get for him? So, yeah, I could say he's a pretty easy sell, but no one's going to pay for him. Even in Coors, you know, they're going to say, no, there's nothing there to really buy. Just sit tight with him. So I'm not necessarily running out and getting him. Even if he's on the wire, I'm not necessarily sure that I'm going to go ahead and get him because I just think he's going to be empty batting average. If that's your primary need, sure. Yeah, he could hit 300 the rest of the way for sure for LeMahieu. But nah, other than that, don't sweat it. Let's get back to Travis because he is the most exciting guy going right now at second base. His 221 weighted runs created plus over at Fangraphs is the highest by far. He is up 50 points on second, which is Howie Kendrick. So Devon Travis, hang on 1 second. Let me take a drink. That's the downside of the solo pod is having to take a drink. Usually I can do it when Doug or any other co-host is talking. But when it's just solo, I have to do it kind of while I'm running. And I guess I could go back and delete them all, but I don't know. I didn't mark what time that was, and I'm not going to do it. So you just heard me take a drink of water. No big deal. Back to Devon Travis. So he came over from the Tigers in a even-up trade of Anthony Gose for Devon Travis. So even though the Tigers gave this guy up in a deal, nobody's upset about this trade. This one-for-one so far has worked out perfectly. Ghost has been fantastic for the Tigers. Travis has been unbelievable for the Jays. Now, Travis is a Florida State pick in the 13th round of the 2012 draft, and he raked throughout the minors. Everywhere Travis went, he hit. He was pretty good in his first year in low A ball, then had a Class A and High A split season in 2013. And raked in both of those. But the thing was, the reason he wasn't getting too much of the prospect hype was because as a college product, he was pretty much at age for those levels. It's not like it was some hot young prospect who was beating up on competition older than him. Travis was mostly playing with guys that he was either equal in age to or maybe even a bit older than. In a lot of cases, he was a little bit older than the competition that he was raking on. But numbers are numbers, so he was starting to get some prospect love. And then in 2014, he had a great season in AA for Erie. And at 23, that's a little bit better of an age-to-level match, but he was still, again, not necessarily some young prospect on the rise. He was more of, okay, you know, you're a bit of a complete hitter who is taking advantage of lesser competition, as you should. And so that's why I don't think he was getting the love that you might have expected from numbers like that from a middle infielder. Well, he ended up making it to the number one spot on the Tigers prospect list. They had Devon Travis there number one, and then a couple days later, he was traded out. So he's finally starting to get some prospect love, although that might have been more because he was part of the Tigers organization, and they've just had a mass exodus from their farm system these last couple of years to get reinforcements to constantly keep their World Series window open. So just because he was a number one prospect for a team, I don't know, that's not created equally. That really depends on the system you're in. If you're the number one prospect in the Cubs system, that says something no matter what. If you're the number one prospect for like the Brewers right now or the Tigers, I'm trying to think of other organizations, or the Angels, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're an automatic stud. But either way, the Blue Jays like Travis enough. They've had a black hole at second base for a while. The outfield's pretty well locked up, and they'd seen Anthony Gose for parts of three seasons do really nothing for them. So they just said, hey, let's do an even up deal. This is your classic challenge trade. Two 24-year-olds with some prospect status to them. Obviously, Gose was no longer a prospect in the sense of a RotoWire list or a baseball prospectus list because of his major league experience, but he's still prospect level in that he only had 616 plate appearances. He's only 24 years old. So, there's still some prospect to him. There was still some shine maybe to be discovered from him. And maybe the Tigers are getting it early on. Anyway, back to Travis. He comes all the way up from Double A, makes the team out of spring training, and has been electric. He's never played Triple A, and he is tearing the league up right now. And what I'm really impressed with is the pop coming out of Travis's bat. He's 5'9", a buck 90. He's got four bombs and five doubles among his 20 hits. He's being a run producer. He's not striking out much. He's walking a good number. When you strike out 12% of the time and you walk 7% of the time, that's excellent. 7% walk rate on its own with like a normal strikeout rate, it's okay. It's not great. But when you're only striking out 12% of the time, that's excellent. That's absolutely fantastic. So things are riding hot for him right now. I don't think Devon Travis is going to maintain a 24% homer to fly ball rate. But there is a lot to like here, and there's a good reason to believe that you could have a double-double guy here. When I say double-double, I mean double digits in homers and stolen bases. Obviously, he's nearly halfway there with the homers, so you can probably expect even a bit more pop. I'm looking right now, it's looking like the Zips projections for the rest of the year, something that you can find on the Fangraphs player pages, have him for 13 homers the rest of the way. Let me see what we've got him here at RotoWire. Let's see for a comparison. How many? Because, so 13 homers there. You know, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibilities that you can get 10 more more home runs from Devon Travis the rest of the way. The speed, he's not a pure burner, and I think the power that we're seeing early on kind of proves that. He never had massive stolen base numbers, 22 in 2013, 16 last year. That's adequate. There's nothing wrong with that, but obviously it's not game changing. And I'm finally getting the numbers here that we've got him for. Let's see, it says rest of the season, just two homers, That seems light. Looking at the rest of the season projections here at RotoWire, has Devon Travis for just two homers the rest of the way. And I think that's coming up way light there. Maybe I'm missing a calculation of some sort, but that's what I'm reading here. And I don't see that as the case for him. I think he's got more than that, although it's not giving him much of a playing time projection either. So maybe this is just taking the early season projection and chopping off those first few games and going from there. I don't know if these are fully updated to reflect what we've seen from Devon Travis thus far. So I'm buying in here. I'm willing to take that plunge and buy in with Devon Travis. Doesn't mean I go out and pay full freight for this and give up, Matt Carpenter. Matt Carpenter's a bad example because he's not a second baseman anymore. I try to keep it position to position, even though I know a lot of those trades don't happen, just to give you an idea of what you should be looking for. Let's see. I'm not trading Pedroia, who's off to a pretty hot start power-wise. I don't think I would do that, of course. Could you go out and trade Colton Wong for Devon Travis? Colton Wong was a very hot sleeper pick coming into the season. He's hitting all right, 295 right now, hitting quite well, actually, with a 12% strikeout and walk ratio. Things are going well. So you could definitely trade him for Devon Travis if you wanted to. Now, that depends how much you believe in Wong. If you bought into Wong because you were super high on him, say like Lar Michaels would never do that deal. He was very high on him. He of Masters Ball, Lar Michaels, very, very good fantasy expert, if you will. He loves Colton Wong, so he's not going to do that trade. But if maybe you just kind of begrudgingly got stuck with Colton Wong, at that point in the draft, he was your top guy, and you just said, nah, I got to do it, whatever. I might entertain that trade. I actually am more in the camp that says I think Colton Wong is going to be really good. I think this batting average that we're seeing early on is legitimate with him, so maybe that is a bad example. Here's one that might be really interesting, and I loved this guy coming into the season, but I'm getting a little bit sketchy on him. It's Brian Dozier. He's still showing the solid strikeout and walk ratios, but the pop isn't there right now. And I'm wondering if maybe it was a bit of a mirage last year or not. The fly ball rate is way down. It's going to need to get in check. I think he had a bit of a home run lull in the second half. So maybe Brian Dozier for Devon Travis. You could definitely get something in addition as well. You could get Devon Travis and something else for Dozier, I imagine, in a lot of situations. So that's a trade I might entertain, something I definitely wouldn't have said a couple weeks ago. And I'm not quick to make wholesale changes on my rankings and my thoughts of guys. But this is a guy who, Devon Travis is a guy who's in a great lineup. He's showing the pop early. It's a great park. And every time I saw him, he just hit. I saw him a couple times in the Arizona Fall League. He wasn't good overall in the fall. I think his full numbers in that Fall League season weren't good. Yeah, he had 236. But I saw one of his two homers. I saw one of his three steals. I saw a couple multi-hit games. He only had 17 hits in the 18 games. I just happened to catch him a couple times when he was hot, I guess. But, you know, and I'd have been hearing the things about how, you know, some prospect mavens don't really love him, et cetera, et cetera. I was like, I don't know. I was kind of excited for the Tigers to have him, but then obviously they had Ian Kinsler. They had no use for him. Once they traded Austin Jackson, the trade became a no-brainer for the Tigers here. But I think Devon Travis is pretty legit. Anyway, I've spent a lot of time on him. Let's move over to third or shortstop, actually. Let's go to shortstop first. And I'm still pretty hot on Brad Miller. And he's off to a pretty good start. He was going way late. Everyone who was burned last year by him, including myself, you know, I was out there scooping him up everywhere I could last year at a low cost, and it did not go well. I stuck with him for quite a while, and it just never really got going for Brad Miller. Well, I went back to the well this year because the price was as good or better. It didn't go up substantially at all. And now Brad Miller's off to an okay start. You know, he's hitting 298. We're seeing some pop. We've only seen the one homer so far, but two stolen bases, some extra base hits. Things are going well. Now, he won the job out of spring kind of by default because Chris Taylor, the competition for Brad Miller, broke his hand, I think. And so that kind of put him out. But he's making the most of this opportunity, and Brad Miller is hitting the ball. At the very worst, I think he's a strong side platoon guy who gets to hit against righties. So that alone is good enough for me at shortstop, but I think they'll give him some opportunities against lefties to try to improve him. Ideally, they would want Brad Miller to be a full-time shortstop, but he's been so wretched against lefties that I don't know that he's going to continue to get opportunities. He's already a 2-for-15 to start this year, but as somebody who can just constantly rake lefties, I'm in there, and I would definitely say that he's a great DFS play because his price has not really moved up in DFS. Obviously, I could say it for tonight, Friday, but by the time you hear this, it might be right before lock or a little bit after lineups lock. So it's useless for tonight. But even going forward, anytime they play a righty, especially a medium or worse righty, I think it's worth it to get Brad Miller in your lineup. All right, now let's move over to third base. And I think what this has turned into, because the names I wrote are just, instead of saying, let's go look at these guys and decide whether or not I believe them, it's actually turned into a list of here's a guy from every position who was a later round pick that I'm starting to believe in, because I don't think I'm going to come full negative on any of these guys here that I've written down. So let's just kind of change the scope here. If you're waiting for me to come out on one of these hot guys and say no dice, I'm selling 100%, I don't think that's going to happen. I think this list of guys that I've written down, I pretty much believe in their hot starts. So for third base, this one isn't the official pick, but I wanted to get him mentioned. It's Luis Valbuena. He's only hitting 220, but he's hitting 220 with five homers. And this is what I wanted from him, power. He hit 249 last year with 16 homers. I think he's going to get more run this year, so the homers could go up. That park is very nice for Luis Valbuena. He qualifies at second and third. I really liked him this year as a very late pick. I'd take another 16 homers, but I think he could push 20 in that ballpark with the playing time he's going to get. I'm pretty stoked on Luis Valbuena, and he's been pretty good. But somebody I want to talk about who's absolutely crushing it, and I've kind of had a change of heart on, because I used to just never buy, and I say, you know what, the ship has sailed here. Let's move on. And I'm still nervous to get fully on board, but I'm really starting to get intrigued. I've thrown him into a few DFS lineups. This is one thing I like about DFS, by the way, and I'm sure as you can tell by now, let's see, how many minutes are we into this? About 42 minutes. You can tell I've gone on a lot of tangents. So here comes another one. One thing I really love about DFS is it's a way for me to buy in on a guy before I'm ready to necessarily buy on him season long. You know, so the third base guy is Mike Moustakas. Never really been a huge fan. Slowly starting to turn around here, but I'm not going to go rush out and buy him in all my season longs. I don't want to make that kind of commitment. So I'll buy him a few times in DFS, and that doesn't mean that if he does well for me, I will move forward, and if he has a couple over four nights, I'm done. What it does is, for me personally, it puts the focus on the guy. If I got a guy in my lineup, I've got a measure of focus on him. That means I've done my deep dive into his stats. I'm very likely to check out some of his at-bats that night, or watch his whole game maybe even. And if I do that a couple times, all of a sudden, now I'm really deep diving into their stats. I'm really starting to get a collection of at-bats that I've seen them play. And then I can make a decision one way or the other about, yeah, I do believe in this guy, or nah, maybe he was just hot to begin with. This is more or less the same guy. Well, so far for me, it's been a bit more of the former with Moustakas. I'm saying, okay, this is something that maybe we can believe in. And, never been a huge walk guy, and still not doing it this year, but never been a huge strikeout guy either. So Moustakas has power, and we've seen some flashes of some great power, but it's never really panned out. And I wonder if maybe if he swung a little bit more freely, it would bring that power. But that's not the approach he wants to have. He wants to have a bit more of a measured approach. And so far this year, he's taken the not striking out thing to a whole new level. He's at 7% this year. Moustakas is a career 16%, which is very good. Again, especially for a guy who, can be a power threat, to have a 16% strikeout rate is very good. 7% is obviously off the charts ridiculous, and it's been paying off for him. Obviously, he's just crushing it. Triple slash of 328, 411, 516, a 321 batting average on balls in play for Moustakas, which isn't even that crazy, by the way. He could sustain that. I think he'll inch closer toward his career mark. He's a 262 career mark, but I think he could probably be, in the 280, 290 range if he is en route to a good season here. But if he stayed at 321 the whole year, it wouldn't be like a Danny Santana thing where you're flipping out saying that's never going to sustain. Danny Santana, for those that don't remember, had a 400 last year, and we all knew that was going to bottom out and take with it his all of his value. We'll see how well Moustakas can hang on to that 321. But even if he comes down into, like I say, the 280, 290 range, it's not going to create his batting average, and he hit .212 last year. So we're already looking at a good scenario for Moustakas to improve his batting average. But now I want to see, can that raw power really stick? And so far it's been good, because one of the things with his approach that I've never been a fan of is, he doesn't have quite the raw power that I would expect. When you see him locked in, the power is there, but it never really translates. 9.7 and 9% homer to fly ball rate these last couple of years. Put a better charge into some of these fly balls. Maybe I'm, blasting him for something that isn't his fault, but he puts the ball in the air a lot. You would think that he would get up near at least a league average homer to fly ball rate, but Moustakas has never been there. So we've seen 20 homers, 12 homers, 15 homers. Okay, whatever, passable. I'll take those homer totals, which probably, what's that average out to, about 17 or something like that, when you take the three totals there. I'll take that with a 270 average. That totally works. 15 homers and 212, no thanks. 12 homers and 232, no thanks. Even 20 homers and 242, okay, I'm listening, but I don't know. If you're not going to strike out, then give me more hits. And so far, Moustakas is doing that. So I'm starting to buy in. I'm starting to dip my toe in. Still a little bit nervous. We'll see if it's going to keep going. But this is at least an endorsement to start getting him in, start trusting him in DFS. It maybe take the same approach I do. If you're not ready to fully buy in, I get it, because it just hasn't been an inspiring set of his early 20s. But keep in mind, he is just 26 too. So that's the fact that he has done all this work in his early 20s suggests that, okay, maybe there's still plenty of time with him. So that's why I'm intrigued by Mike Moustakas. Next up, we're going to do just three random outfielders here. I'm not doing a right fielder, a center fielder, and a left fielder, because most leagues don't care about that. So we're just talking about three outfielders here. The first one is a center fielder, and it's Moustakas' teammate. It's Lorenzo Cain. Now, this one, I will freely admit, I try to keep my biases to myself, but, not let them seep into the analysis, because it doesn't help anybody, but I usually make them known if they're out there. I really love Lorenzo Cain. I like the way he plays ball. Great defense. Looks like he can be a big prime time hitter. So maybe I just want him to be good, and that's part of it. I love his story. You know, he got cut from the high school basketball team and really just wanted to compete in something and decided, hey, I'm going to play baseball. And I think it was Andy McCullough who wrote a great story about him in the Kansas City Star about, you know, kind of his transition into baseball. Didn't know the rules, didn't know anything, and has built himself up into a quality major leaguer. That's a great story. But I want to see Lorenzo Cain have a big season. Even last year, that was a good season for him, for sure. But it wasn't, you know, elite necessarily. 5 homers, 28 stolen bases, that's great. 301 average, that's great. But just like I said, the 5 homers. He was great in the playoffs. I think that, you know, added to his shine this year. But it's not like he was, you know, I think it was more defense than it was offense. Yeah, he hit .333 with an .805 OPS. Okay, no, he was good in the playoffs. I'm not taking that away from him. But it's not like he hit like 6 homers. Didn't Moustakas hit a bunch of homers in the playoffs? I'm pulling that up right now. Yeah, he hit 5 homers. So for him, for Moustakas to have been inflated based on his playoffs, I get. For Kane, we got to be a little bit more careful. So as much as I like this guy, I've been really excited, and he's off to a great start. I still didn't even invest in him that much because I thought the price was a little bit higher than he was going to be able to necessarily pay off. But early on, it's looking like I might have had it wrong. And one of the pieces that I wish I'd known coming in was that backstory about how he got into baseball, about how he hasn't really been playing since high school. Because what that does is it makes this 29-year-old not necessarily baseball 29. I think that we could see a late breakout here because of his path, because he is really finally having it click. He didn't have 15 years, or I guess it'd be closer to like 10 or 12 years of playing experience, you know, once he was hitting in high school. That's when he started. So he's really just kind of almost not in his baseball infancy, but maybe in his baseball adolescence. And so I do think that Cain might be ready for a big, you know, like a substantial breakout, like a 16 homer, 30 stolen base, you know, 300 plus average kind of season. That would be a monster season. I love everything I'm seeing out of him except for the constant fighting with this team. Yordano Ventura has been being a clown about stuff and really setting his team off into all these different fights. But Kane's been part of it too. You know, he's been getting hit, which I understand is never cool, but really he's got a big issue with Jeff Samardzija right now. And I don't think that's a fight that he wants to pick. Not that Cain is some shrimp. He runs 6'3", 210, I believe. Not, you know, but Shark we're talking about is, 6'9"? No, I'm just kidding. He's 6'5", 230, though. He's a beast. He was a prominent wide receiver in, the highest of high college football. Notre Dame isn't great. I'm sure there's Notre Dame lovers and Notre Dame haters listening. I know they're not that great anymore, but that, you know, they're playing the prime teams out there. Samardzija is not going to back down from anybody. So let's keep yourself healthy, Cain. Again, that goes back to my biggest concern about, not that he was going to get in a fight and get hurt, but the injury piece. What makes Cain so electric, the defense, is the thing that can be his downfall in fantasy too, though. Goes out for some diving catches, gets hurt. You know, he's ready to go balls to the wall with that stuff all the time, which you love, but it also puts you at risk injury-wise. So I'm still a little bit concerned about that overall. But if somebody's trying to sell high on him and you think that price isn't really high, you know, you're not scared off by it. Let me think of some names. I'm really bad at this on the fly, and I apologize of just coming up with names that I would say, you know, let's see, could you get him for him kind of stuff. Let's see. I don't even know if I would do that. I don't know. I would listen to something with like a Cain for Calhoun. I know people love Cole Calhoun. But here's the thing. I think that wouldn't even have to be the one for one. I might be able to get something else. You know, I don't know. Maybe, like I said, I'm pretty terrible at this. What about somebody else who's doing well? A guy who used to be a big part of maybe they were traded for each other. No. They were in the same organization, Cain and Will Myers. They were both Royals together. Myers is off to a great start, and he's shown some pedigree in the past. But I feel like if you believed in Cain and somebody came asking for Myers, you could do that. I think that would be perfectly fair. You know, something that I think you could try to do, even if you had to throw in a little bit of the extra chip that I'd be willing to do, is Angel Pagan for Lorenzo Cain. Angel Pagan and a little upgrade somewhere else for Lorenzo Cain. Because as much as I do worry about Kane's health because of the great all-out defense he plays, Pagan has a similar situation. He plays all out too, and he continually gets hurt, and he's older. So with Pagan, you're dealing with a 33-year-old, and with Kane, you're dealing with a 29-year-old. That 4 years of difference for me is enough to say, okay, I'll take on the inflated Kane right now, who's definitely going to back off the numbers somewhat, over Pagan, who's been playing well, but hasn't been, you know, the over-the-top player just yet. But I do worry that Pagan will get hurt. So that's one for sure. Let's see. Could I think of any other names? You know, this one could definitely maybe even get you like a prime piece back. What about like a Matt Holliday for Lorenzo Kane's situation? Holliday's not off to a bad start. He's hitting 383 with a 492 on base, but just a 404 slugging. The power has been waning a little bit here, and I expect Holliday to burst out power-wise. He'll get it going. I'm not too worried about that, but again, you're talking about 35 against 29-year-old, and if you could get an alluring piece back, you can get some impressive young arm that is a bit of a gamble. Let's say Lorenzo Cain and Drew Pomeranz for Matt Holliday. Now, that'd be like a 15-team mixed league probably, because you got to have all parties being owned, and Pomeranz is probably available in some 10-teamers. He should be on a lot of 12-team leagues, so maybe that's a 12-team scenario. That's pretty specific because, you know, one team has to have Kane and Pomeranz, Holliday. Yeah, Kane and Pomeranz for Holliday. So you would be trading Holliday for those two. But a Pomeranz-type arm, and there's hundreds of them. And you could do that if you needed the pitching. You feel like you're taking a Kane, and that guy feels like he's selling high on Kane. Great. Do something like that. So, yeah, for the most part, I believe in Kane. I just want to see him stay healthy. That's my biggest concern for him. My other outfield, and you know what? It could apply to all these outfielders. I actually have four outfielders, and they all play pretty balls-to-the-wall, all-out defense, which makes me excited about them as players, but also puts them in harm's way, and they all have that same kind of cloud of, dang it, are they going to get hurt making some great diving play, and I lose that fantasy production from them. So next one on that list is AJ Pollock. I love this guy. Been a big fan of his game. Was really high on him last year, and he had a fantastic season when he played. But it was just 75 games, and I think it was I don't think it was defense. I think it was hit. He got hit by a pitch, and it broke his hand, and he missed a boatload of time. I think he missed 4 months on. No, 3 months. June, July, and August. I think he missed all 3 months there, and that's rough. That's disastrous. But he was fantastic when he played, and he's come out of the gate, hit the ground running right away in this season already. Pollock is hitting 358, 417, 472 for his triple slash. Only one homer, but two stolen bases. He scored 12 runs, so I'll take that. Seven ribbies. It's all looking pretty solid so far. Not over the top. Nothing that's going to cost you an arm and a leg. If you did want to go out and buy, you could easily say, listen, guy's playing well. I'm interested in buying him, but you're not going to get me paying through the nose necessarily to get him. I'll still pay, you know, maybe a little bit above his market from the draft. And I've got him from Fantasy Pros having gone at pick 168. So maybe you pay a top 150 guy for him, but maybe somebody you're not as keen on in the top 150, and then you get Pollock. As much as the Diamondbacks, a lot of people thought they were going to be a bad team this year, myself included. I thought they're going to finish second to last in that division, and that's where they are right now. But they are 8-7 because there are four teams in the NL West that are above 500 right now, which is impressive. But even though I didn't love the Diamondbacks this year, it was because of their pitching, not their hitting. I actually feel like the middle of that lineup's pretty solid. When you got Goldschmidt there, Pollock, Trumbo, I thought was going to bounce back and you know, at least be a power threat this year, and I think that's what's going to happen. He's still going to be the guy. Doesn't have a great on base, but can pop it. Chris Owings, David Peralta, some of these smaller pieces. Jake Lamb. I thought it was going to be an okay offense, obviously led by Goldschmidt and Pollock. But the complementary pieces I figure are going to be pretty solid for them to cover up, you know, for Nick Ahmed and Tuffy Goswish. And hey, they seem dead set on Pete O'Brien as a catcher. I'm not sure he can do it, but getting the bat in the lineup would definitely be an upgrade over Goswish. So anyway, the point is that I do believe that Pollock can be one of these guys, maybe up at the top of the lineup, who isn't necessarily a huge run producer. So he might be like a, 13 homer guy and 60 ribbies, but could be in the 90 run scored area with a great batting average. So that's what you're looking at Pollock for. And honestly, I feel like, they could legitimately bump him down in the lineup, and he could be a bigger power threat and a run producer type if they needed. But the fact is, they can use him as a leadoff hitter because he works that well. So as a one or two hitter, I think he's in a great position there, because, the lineup doesn't have to be deep 1 through 9 to be useful. If you're hitting ahead of Paul Goldschmidt, that a lot of good things are going to happen for you. So I like A.J. Pollock a lot. Next on the list of early performing outfielders that I like, but I do worry about possibly breaking down, includes Mr. Steven Souza. And so that is, he came in with a lot of fanfare this year because the projection systems ended up loving him despite, limited work in the majors and unimpressive at that. He was he hit 130 in his 26 plate appearances with the Nationals last year, but a rich minor league history. And maybe I think they saw him as a little bit more refined because he's coming in at age 26. This is kind of his debut season at age 26, so he maybe is a little bit more of a polished prospect. Like I said, the projection systems were really high on him. A lot of them gave him high double-double seasons, like teens, 17 homers, 18 stolen bases, 20-20 in some instances. The Pacoda system over at Baseball Prospectus, loved Steven Souza. And he's been off to a great start. 4 homers, 4 stolen bases, 11 ribbies, 6 runs, 268 average isn't great, but I'll take a 349 on base and a 536 slugging. Now, he is swinging and missing quite a bit, 37% strikeout rate. That's got to come down, but I believe that it will. And, one of the reasons that you'll see so often fantasy analysts say relax after, 6 or 7 games is because I'm sure after like 7 games, people were asking about Steven Souza, saying, oh, why does this guy suck? What's wrong with him? He had a 491 OPS after his first 7 games. But since then, he's been on fire with a 1089, and all of a sudden, he went from a cold start to a hot start. That's because 7 games isn't really a cold start. It's just not enough to really make that distinction that he has actually started cold. I don't know what the threshold is, but that's why a lot of times the advice might be a little bit bland to just say, relax, hold. But that's the truth. That's what you have to do. So you drafted Souza hoping for a breakout. You can't be cutting him after 7 games because then you miss the next 9 when he absolutely goes off. So I'm buying in on this. I think there's some legitimacy to him as a power speed combo. Again, the only concern, he plays a lot of all-out D, made that excellent catch to wrap up Jordan Zimmerman's no-hitter last year. So Souza could put himself in a little bit of harm's way that way. But you can't really plan for that and worry about guys because a lot of outfielders play all out. Defense is a bigger part of the game these days. So you can't just go get the loafs and say, well, they'll stay healthy. I mean, Haylor Ramirez is not known for defense, but he gets hurt all the time too. So you can't really plan for it. It's just something to keep in mind. And then the last of the group here is maybe the best defender of them all, to be honest. And he's shown it off very nicely early on. That's Jock Peterson. Now, this is another rookie that I didn't really get a chance to get many shares of him this year, despite my many leagues. It wasn't, again, it wasn't an active, I'm not interested situation. It was there are other guys available at this time that I don't end up with Peterson. It was that kind of situation. I'm kind of wishing I would have ended up with Peterson a little bit more, even though I was worried that there was some inflated hype for him. Maybe it wasn't, because so far it's been really good for him. That defense is going to keep him on the field, for one. So that's a part where the defense can really help you. And that's why I do like getting these defensive stalwarts, because they stay on the field and they keep getting the reps at the dish, and maybe they can improve themselves if they aren't great hitters, like an Angelton Simmons. Think of Yadier Molina. He was so good as a catcher, so they just kept playing him. He was garbage as a hitter. But for years, he just kind of was incrementally getting better. Then all of a sudden, he turned himself into an all-star hitter. Peterson doesn't even have to worry about that. He's already a good hitter. But I'm just saying, this is one way that you can look at defense and say, oh, this might be a good way to utilize defense as a fantasy asset, is these guys will probably get a lot of playing time. So Peterson's not going anywhere. So he could struggle, and he'll hit a wall. He'll hit a rookie wall at some point. But so far, it's been electric. He has been awesome. 295, 446, 523, triple slash, two bombs, four doubles, six ribbies. Now, the one piece that's not been great is a 1-for-4 on the stolen base path right now. Got to sharpen that up, or else you'll be given at least a yellow light, if not a full-on red light, and he won't be able to run. But everything else is so good that it's tough to even get mad. Obviously, he's been drafted as a power-speed combo, so if he really got slowed on the base paths and wasn't allowed to run, that would be a disappointment. But I don't see that happening. I think he's just off to a tough start, learning how to read major league pitchers, things like that. I think he'll be all right. At the very worst, I think he'll still steal at least 17 bags, you know, something like that in the mid-teens there. At the very least, I still think he's a great bet for 25. Now, the key is, can he put 25 homers with it? I don't know yet. You know, that's a lofty number to put on a rookie. But I do think he can do 18 to 20, which that's an amazing season. 18 to 20 homers, 23, 25 steals with a decent average. That's fantastic. One thing I really love about him is, even though he strikes out, and he loves to strike out, he's right up there with Souza at 33%. He also takes walks. He's at 21% with his walks early on. So this guy has an idea of what's going on up there. And yeah, he's going to get himself into some deep counts. And with deep counts comes strikeouts. That's just part of it. But I'll take those strikeouts when you're delivering that kind of production, when you do make contact, and also delivering walks on the times, you know, some of the times when you aren't striking out. So there's a lot to love with Jock Peterson's profile, and it's easy to see why people were so psyched on him coming into the year. So that wraps that up in terms of touring, you know, looking at a handful of guys that early on I'm buying in on. And, you know, doesn't necessarily mean I can go out and get them in every league, because, yeah, you would have to pay a tax, and it's just not smart to always buy guys at their highest. But if you pick a name or two out there and you're, you know, searching for offense in a league, you could maybe go out there and buy them and trade them to somebody or trade them from somebody thinking, and they're thinking, hey, I'm getting out from under this, so I'll take something that, you know, looks like a good value but might not represent full value. And you're thinking, hey, this isn't a bad trade. I'm maybe paying a little bit higher than draft day cost, but if you're not paying an exorbitant price, I still think you're getting back a really good player. And again, I'll run those names over. It's Steven Vogt, Lucas Duda, Devon Travis, Brad Miller, Mike Moustakas, Lorenzo Cain, AJ Pollock, Steven Souza, and Jock Peterson. If there were a couple that I'm most high on in terms of that I'd really like to go out and buy, it would include Steven Vogt, Lucas Duda, and probably AJ Pollock, if I'm a little bit cool on, the ones I'm coolest on in terms of them really staying at a star level. I'm still a little bit nervous about Moustakas, as I mentioned. And then the two rookies, Souza and Peterson, be careful because they're rookies, you know. Let's put this in perspective. Let me pull this up really fast. Remember how great Gregory Polanco was upon arrival last year. I'm getting the actual numbers, so you're gonna have to bear with me while I'm doing that. But he came out and he hit the ground running. He had hits in his first 11 games, and through his first through those first 11 games, he had an 863 OPS. You know, he was crushing it through his first month. He was hitting 288 with a 749 OPS. By the time that, you know, he got settled in, and he was up for most of the season, or for a good more than half the season last year. He came up in early June and was up the rest of the way. If you just go from his first month on, he had a 610 OPS and a 213 average. The major leagues are hard, so hitting the ground running doesn't guarantee you anything. So that's why I'd be careful about necessarily going out and buying rookies, but you do have to take some calculated gambles at times, and I think there's a lot to like in the skill sets of these guys that we've seen. So that's why it's, you know, I apologize if it sounds like a fence straddling situation. It's really not. I'm saying that I believe that these skills are legitimate, but with any rookie, I'm going to be careful. It's just as simple as that, especially after, you know, 3 weeks of time. that's why if you do want to go out and buy some of these guys, maybe look toward the veterans. And that would be actually a better case for Moustakas, who I did say I'm a little bit cool on. That's just because we have seen a lot so far from him that suggests that, well, we don't know how good he is. But Duda has had a lot of quality in his past track record, so that's a pretty easy one to buy on. But then Vogt, you know, he is still pretty fresh, but I do buy in on him. I think Oakland knew what they were doing when they're trading Derek Norris, moving John Jaso. John Jaso didn't need to be behind the dish anymore anyway because of the concussions and stuff, but they knew what they were doing when they were going to make Steven Vogt their number one catcher with Josh Fegley behind him, and I think they're going to have a pretty strong platoon there this year. With Vogt getting the majority of the work for sure. So anyway, Doug and I will be back next week. I'm sure that, I'll tell you what, I shouldn't say for certain that we're going to be back next week because we're going to be even closer to his baby coming, and he and his wife might have to be doing other things, so I might have to go solo again next Friday. If I do, I'll do the same thing that I did today for pitchers, where I'll cover the ones that have been good early, that were deeper round picks, and decide whether or not I like them. That one will be more of a yes, I believe, no, I don't, because it'll just be, say, like 10 guys. Maybe Doug and I will do that either way. So whether it's me solo or I'm with Doug, we'll go through 10 guys who are excelling right now, well beyond their draft point, and we'll say, hey, we buy in or we don't. But until then, take care. Have a good weekend. Bye.